They need extra time.
Well, we might as well get going. Sugar, help yourselves anytime, especially if you start to pass out today. Remember, we wanted to pick some articles that you're maybe interested in, and if you're having a hard time trying to find something, I just want to show you there's some really cool journals. So, like, Journal of Comparative Physiology is really good. And these journals specialize in certain topics. Like, this one's neuroethology. You know what ethology? Remember what ethology is? Ethology? Did we talk about ethology? Have you all ever had an ecology class, right? Did you talk about ethology? In their natural environment. So that's kind of the difference of just behavior versus ethology is more or less in their natural environment. You probably covered it in ecology somewhat. Did you have to take ecology? No? Yes, you forgot. You purged it all. Okay. So, but it is kind of interesting, and I think of it on a comparative aspect too. So who are the people that got the Nobel Prize for ethology? Way back when. Ecology should have covered it pretty heavily, but I think they skip it. Conrad Lorenz, remember Conrad Lorenz? You remember Conrad Lorenz? Hear about him? Gray lag geese. So they imprinted on him when the mother was taken away, and he, you know, when the eggs hatched, he was there to take care of them. And so they imprinted on him. They followed him all around, right? So that was the imprinting. And then Carl van Frisch, Conrad Lorenz was Austrian. Carl van Frisch was Austrian also. And he's the one that did the bee dance behavior. So bees go out, come back to the hive, and they do the dance. And there's something really interesting about that, because to know where they go, and we could cover that if you wanted to, but it's not really compared fizz so much. But what's really interesting is Clara Rykoff over in entomology over here on campus, she's studying how bees go out, collect the nectar and put it all on them, you know, the bee. But then how much energy does the bee have to be able to, how far they go to be able to come back? Isn't that wild? Because if they go too far, they might not have the energy reserves to get back, because they can't just eat that nectar. They have to wait, put it in the hive and eat the honey, you know, that kind of thing. So she's studying about how do they know that. And so she's trying to change their energy storage and then see if they won't fly as far, or if they have more energy or more high quality energy, could they fly farther? I think that's just wild, right? That's really wild. And then the other guy, Nikki Tinbergen, he was the guy that did the digger wasp in Den Haag, Netherlands. So the wasp goes in the beach, goes down and burrows in the sand, flies up, and then how did they ever find out to come back to that little hole? So he studied this idea, and what he did is he watched this as an undergraduate. And when he was on the beach, he watched these wasps, digger wasps, that would come out of the hole and do a hovering behavior. And then he realized they're hovering wider and wider and wider before they take off. And then he watched the wasps come back to that hole, and they would kind of fly over. But as soon as they saw that platform, they would start doing the circle and hit that hole right in. And when you think of a beach, sandy beach, that's amazing. So those three got the Nobel Prize together in ethology. So Vincent Dutour is the guy that is the kind of the American neuroethologist. Anybody ever hear of Vincent Dutour? No, maybe not. So there are fellowships for you if you apply to these summer programs, and I encourage you to do it. Their applications are right now, really. They're making, you know, choices. And these summer programs, like this one, is at Puget Sound. It's in Washington State. The islands off of Washington State, they have a really good marine lab. It's not just to study marine biology, cell biology, as well as genetics. But Vincent Dutour's granddaughter gives fellowships. She still works out there, and she gives fellowships to students if you apply and you can get a fellowship. So my grad student, Sonia Bierbauer, one time applied to do an ethology course, and she got Vincent Dutour's scholarship. And actually, they come and pick you up and fly you by helicopter to Puget Sound to go, you know, study. It's really quite cool. So if you're interested in summer programs and you want to get involved in some course, usually a lot of these courses have fellowships for you. Once you apply, they don't really say it right off the bat that you're going to get one, but usually there's so much endowment money that once you're accepted into a course, and these courses are internationally competitive, so you really have to, you know, say why you're interested. And then they usually have fellowships for you once you're into the course, and so it's usually free. So two of the students in my lab went to Cold Spring Harbor in East Coast, and another one went to Woods Hole for a course, and they all had their full fellowships. They just had to get there, and that was the only cost. And there's really good courses out there to take these advantage of. So if you look up for these courses, summer courses, marine biology programs, some of them aren't just on marine biology, they're everything. Some of them now are just on computational neurobiology, so programming if you're really into that. You know. Not me, but anyways, others might be. Okay, so that's just something to think about if you're interested. So the idea here is to find something that might be interesting for you, and you look through these, and what you could do is, I think it'd be really cool if you looked through the table of contents and looked at their, you know, recent papers that they have, and we can pick some of these if you want to go over in class if you find it's really interesting, but you don't want to present it, but maybe we can do it as a group. I mean, electrosensitivity, plant hoppers, that's pretty cool. Albatross, whatever, you know, there's lots of things. So this one is Journal of Comparative Physiology A, and you can see the subtitles that they specialize in here. And then you look at Journal of Comparative Physiology B, and you find out they specialize in environmental physiology, systems, and biochemistry. Okay, so pretty cool. It depends what you're interested in, if you want to, you know, cover more details on cellular mechanisms. Exercise, chronic cold induces, really torpor in the summer. You know, torpor is kind of like hibernation, but in summer you call that estivation. So squirrels, for example, in real hot days, they can go down in their burrow and they will basically, like hibernation, decrease their metabolism. We could talk about estivation if we want to. And it's kind of just like hibernation. Everything is to slow down to decrease their heat because it's so hot outside, they don't want to be outside, and so they're cooling down. So this is something we could talk about too. And you could bring in the metabolism that we talked about at the very beginning with these fire of life cycles. That's wild. I don't know what that's about, but you know, different things. All right, so let's close that one. And so that was the physiology B one. There's even another journal. So there's A and B on that one. Then this one is comparative biochemistry and physiology, and they have three parts. This one's toxicology and pharmacology, using animals basically as, you know, understanding some of the toxicology in the environment, but also using them as study animals, like, you know, testing out new drugs, for example. This is kind of interesting too. So there's lots of things here. We talked about ammonia stress before, you know, for long-term exercises that might build up nitrogen bases, so that's ammonia. So there's lots of different potential topics that we could look at if you're interested. And lots of different weird animals. Here's a sea cucumber study. All right, so that one is kind of neat too. And then that was C, toxicology and pharmacology. Then they have another one called A, which is molecular and integrative physiology, same general journal, comparative biochemistry. And these are pretty good. They're not the impacts that you might get in healthcare journals, because of the citations are mostly for comparative physiologists, right? So if you looked at a cancer journal, the impact factor is a lot higher, but there's not that many people out there in the world that are going to cite, you know, your work on a sea cucumber in its ability to handle hypoxia. But still, these are the top journals. So this one's maybe more of interest to you, molecular and integrative physiology, and it's the same main editor. Lots of cool topics. Cold-induced RNA binding. We talked a little bit about cold. We could pick up on some of these papers if you want to. There's a thermal adaptation. Another one on temperature if you want to cover on some more on temperature. Gosh, I don't even know what a Zorkas is. What is a Zorkas? Anybody have an idea? Let's find out. What on earth is that thing? Let's see, maybe they'll tell us. Plateau Zorkas. Good grief. What are those? Subterranean rodents. I would have never guessed. Okay, so, I mean, we could pick up something wild like that if you want to. We learn new things. I remember when I was an undergraduate, we had to pick topics to read about, and I picked a topic on wallabies because I didn't know what a wallaby was, so that was kind of fun. Okay, so, you know, pick something fun, and if you find something in there you want to cover as a class, we can get the paper and distribute it, and we can chit-chat about it, all right? So that's that one. Here's one more on biochemistry, if you really like biochemistry. You just love biochemistry. I know everybody loved that course. And you can see the impact factor dropped a lot on that one for comparative biochemistry. But there is such a thing as comparative biochemistry. There's even specific journals just on comparative biochemistry. But here's alpha-ketic glutarate, like we talked about that, you know, and how that could be utilized in the TCA cycle separate. Hemolymph, lipoproteins of crustaceans and solids. Wow, wild. Okay, so lots of good things to study in that one too. And then there's another journal, and this journal is really probably of the higher end. Let's see, where is it? This one is, well, it's Journal of Comparative Neurology. It's pretty detailed. And it's specifically on neurology, but comparative aspects. You can read some of these unexpected evolutionary divergence, tachykinin, which works on your heart as well. This is interesting. Lots of different aspects that we can get into using it on a comparative aspects, which gives us more understanding of us, for example. So if you're interested in a particular topic, then there's the American Physiological Society. If you're not familiar with that, we do have a chapter in Kentucky, started this year will be 11 years now, and we had that basically, it's going to be here at UK this year, the meeting. It'll be in August, and the first 50 students that sign up is free, you don't have to pay anything. If you're in town, and it's the national organization's American Physiological Society, so they have chapters in different states. So we have a Kentucky chapter. Interesting enough, even when we have the presentation here, like a couple years ago, there were more people from U of L that presented here at UK than the UK students. So that was kind of embarrassing. But anyways, a lot of undergraduates are, if you're working in any kind of physiology, present a poster. And it's really low key. What they're trying to do is promote students to continue in research, right? So it's not to drill you or grill you, it's to have fun. Say, hey, this is what I'm doing. And maybe if you're not even working in a lab, but you found a particular topic, one that you might be wanting to present here, make a poster out of it and say, hey, this was something that was really interesting to me. I read this paper. This is what this paper is about. And this is really cool. I was wondering maybe if there's continued research on that, and make a poster out of that. That's okay, completely okay. And what you could do, if you're really thinking of doing something like that, double dip it, because the Showcase of Scholars is coming up at the end of April, right? It's always the week before, you know, it's like dead week. It's that Wednesday here at UK in the student ballroom, free. And they give, what's nice is they have a little spread of food and things like that, so that's not so bad. In the afternoon, there's so many people that do this now. There's a afternoon session, two different sessions, so it goes like from 1 to 2:30, and then they switch. So there's all the posters are out there. And then maybe at 2:30 to 4, there's the other posters. And so you have time. So you take your poster up. That used to be that it was just one session because there weren't that many. But now so many students are presenting, and it's mostly just for undergraduates. And it's free. So I suggest you could put a poster for that. Save your poster, because you can have a free poster printing here at UK in the Office of Undergraduate Research. And I think you can submit the graduate posters too. And they'll give you a poster printing for free. Saves you money, $120 from Kinko's. Print the poster, use it for Showcase, and what do? Turn it around and use it for in August for the Kentucky Physiological Society. Got two abstracts in, you got your resume going up, you got presentations, you're looking at grad school, med schools, or whatever. It shows you're not afraid to get out and talk, right? And present work, and it builds up your resume for whatever reason it might be. But it's just good because these are low-key, not stressful. They're not grilling you. It's not a science fair. They're just wanting to help encourage you to continue with research, okay? The Showcase is a little bit even more low-key. I think a lot of graduating seniors, undergraduates present there. And that's for undergraduates, so the showcase, sorry. So if you're a graduate student. But it's good to go to, or you find a undergraduate that wants to present, and then you put your name on there. Thank you, and I find one in your labs. That one's pretty low-key. I think a lot of the undergraduates that are graduating, they invite their families, you know, their parents, and it's more or less, I think, a lot of socializing because it's their last semester and they're graduating and they say goodbye to their friends and all that kind of good stuff too. But still, there's so many good posters, and you go and see what they're doing or other labs. Or if you're not a senior and you're thinking about research for next semester, this is the time to talk to people that they're in that lab, and you find out what that lab is like. If you're interested in graduate programs, also a good thing to see, hey, what is it like in that lab? Or, you know, what would it be like for a graduate program in that lab, right? Really good things to do. The Kentucky Physiological Society has a whole separate division for science education. So if you're interested in that, how to present science to, and this year they're going to specialize in that. They actually have someone coming to talk about AI and things like that. So that'd be really cool. And we usually have somebody from College of Ed, a faculty that also present in there too. And then you can really triple dip it, if you're still around, the Kentucky Academy of Sciences, KAS, Kentucky Academy of Sciences, will present sometime in November, and then you can use the same poster again, but a whole other meeting, right? And where is KAS going to be this year? I think they're going to have it at Center. I think it's still under the works, but I think they're going to try to have it at Center, or maybe U of L, and it'd be at the Shelbyville campus, I think, so it's closer, so you don't have to go into Louisville. You can just do the Shelbyville campus. They have a campus that's pretty nice. So here's three presentations you can get. And the KAS has a special division in science ed as well. So that's pretty good because they want to help bring teachers in and promote science education or whatever. So the KAS is all things, ag, engineering, physics, chemistry, a little bit of everything. There's usually quite a bit of, it's like a two-day meeting. There's just a tremendous amount of activity all over in different divisions if you're interested in engineering and everything. Okay, so lots of opportunities to do things, build up resumes. So anyways, the American Physiological Society does have journals too, and some of these are more comparative basis. You know, you can see what these are here. A lot of it's all clinical. Some of them only want clinical aspects. Journal of Applied Physiology is pretty good. They're more on a comparative aspect as well. So they take a lot of comparative work. You know, you can see their type of topics that they're interested in, hypoxic and mice, because, you know, they're, a lot of our understanding of us comes from understanding how other animals function. So these are really good to look up to if you're interested. I just found this one that was really cool. This is in another division called Regulatory, Integrative, and Comparative Physiology, part of American Physiological Society. And these are pretty rigorous reviewed articles. So this one's kind of neat. Before you start an exercise about, you know, warming up, for example, and helping the blood flow to get to your muscles, and they're finding out how much better that is, and just kind of like, okay, I'm going to go jog today, and you just start jogging, you know. Really do the exercise ahead of time, and you don't have that initial fatigue that you're going to have when you start off, and you're like, I can't really do this. So this could make you a better, you know, for exercising or competitive sports if you want to. So pretty interesting in aspects with that. I thought that was really cool because getting you psychologically ready in that autonomic nervous system and vasodilation, all that good stuff, which relates to smooth muscle today that we're talking about. I like that one. That's pretty cool. And if you can get some of these journals, when you click on it, you can't get the PDF right away, but you just go to Interlibrary Loan at UK, go to Libraries, go to Interlibrary Loan under the Journals, and hit what you want to put, and you fill all that in, your email's in there, and they will get that article for you. These journals cost the university so much money to have a normal subscription. I mean, I think these journals now are almost at $10,000 a year just to have the subscription. So UK cut a tremendous number of journals out of their annual subscriptions because it was costing the university, you know, a lot of money. And so what they did is they cut out a lot of these journals, and they said it's cheaper for us to buy the article that you're interested in. So when you do that, they pay the fee, $20 sometimes, for just getting the PDF, And they'll send it to you in your email, or that you log in to do the interlibrary loan. And that was cheaper for the university. So even though you can't get it right away, it's like, we don't have access, just do the interlibrary loan and you'll get access to it. And the university has saved a lot of money in that aspect.
I also know that a lot of journals now are requiring you to publish open access, mm-hmm. so you can just access it like,
exactly. Which is costing
so much money.
It's costing the authors a lot of money. But people want their papers out. And now if you have grants, you write that down on your grant. But if you don't have a grant, how do you pay for that? The journals now, some of those are $4,000.
Yeah.
You know, and some of the journals are cheaper. So comparative biochemistry, physiology, this is why we submit to them. You can choose open access, or you can submit it without open access, but then it's free publication, but then there's an embargo on like sending it out and everything, because if somebody wants it, they have to pay the journal to get that. Or you can be out the money, you could write your own personal check, or you could see if you get a grant, or beg the university to maybe pay for an undergraduate journal. We did that before because it wasn't part of our main research, and the university said, okay, we'll give you 200 here, and then you beg the department 200 here, and the journal at that time, Comparative Physiology, was charging 1200. And so, okay, well, all right, where's the 1000 going to come from? Oh, I love my undergraduates so much in the lab. You write a check and you do it. You know, so these are really something to think about in science. And if funding goes down, what do you think the subscriptions are doing to these journals? They're going down. I mean, you know, because you can't afford, if your grants are going down, you're not getting your grants, you can't submit your papers because it's so expensive. But on your grant, if you don't have it written in for publication charges, then you can't use grant money to pay it. So you have to think about how you're going to do it. And then if you didn't publish, you didn't use that section of your grant, so then you don't get to use that money. It's insanity. It's so much paperwork involved. You just say, it's time to retire.
I just went through this whole process of like publishing a paper and everything, and it was so tedious because every journal like basically was open access. And since my research was funded by the NIH, it used to be that like you could publish it not open access, and then after a year it would become open access,
yeah.
and you could publish it on PubMed. And then in June of this year, they just changed it. So now it has to be open access immediately.
Yep.
So it was so frustrating because I like kept formatting it for this journal, and then it was like, oh, you can't use that one anymore.
Because yep. It's too expensive, right?
Way too expensive.
How much is that one now?
The one that I was originally going to publish to was like $4,000.
Yep.
And then I found that if you go through Sage, because UK has like a, you could do it, but some schools like Harvard and Yale and the Big Ten schools, they pay a subscription like every year for all of their students to bypass open access fees in like Sage and some other journals. And I'm like, that's why kids at those schools have like 7 review undergraduate research papers.
Yes.
Because they don't have to pay $4,000
yes.
each one.
Yes. Yes. Try to tell higher administration if they want undergraduate research, you gotta ante up. And so what they turn around and say, and get more grants. So we can have the indirects to be able to use that. Because indirect, you submit a grant now, I think it's, what is it, 52% of your grant to NIH is indirect money. So if you want $100,000 to do your research, you have to write, I want a $200,000, $100,000, you know, even more than that, will go to the university as indirects to manage whatever, I don't know, buildings, administrators' salaries, or whatever it costs. They say to keep the lights on in the building. That's a lot of money, right? And this is another thing when you look at rankings of universities, like what you're just mentioning, Johns Hopkins and other places, Tulane, for example, is a good ranking university as well, the med school. They have 100% indirects. So you have your works for $100,000, it's double it because they have 100% indirects. So you got to double yours. So when the rankings come out, how do you rank universities, on research universities? How much grant money they get? But it's not fair. It's apples and oranges because they're 100% indirect. So they have to double their grants. So the grants have to be double the size. And ours is 51, I think 52 maybe now, percent of an indirect. So the grant doesn't have to be inflated as much. But if you listen to the current administration, they're saying that is insane. That's wasting money. The university shouldn't be funding. This is politics. I'll just I'm just laying it straight out, is that, that we shouldn't be funding off taxpayers private universities in indirects. If you want to go there and you want to publish there, then that's your thing. So they want to make the indirects cost on research grants the same across the board. Pros and cons to it all. But these universities like Johns Hopkins, Harvard, yeah, they live off of grant money. They live off of grant money because they make a lot of money. UK used to make more money off grants, indirects, than we did from tuition. And so they were really pushing that. And then a couple number of years back, they were finding out we got more money from tuition, a lot from foreign students, and a lot from non-Kentucky students, because it's so expensive to go to school in Illinois, for example, that they would want to come here and pay out-of-state tuition. So they were making more money that. So this is why they increased enrollment, because more money was coming in that way. But they still, of course, push the grants and indirects, because that's free money for them to do whatever they want to do with. Wow. So this is the differences, you know, you kind of have to pay attention if you're interested. And we've never gone through that when we were undergraduates and you go to grad school. So it was kind of like a wake-up call to lots of things that happen outside. It used to be the journals used to charge for color figures. Remember we published an article in a postdoc in Canada. And the one figure was $2,000 because it was color. And so what people do is, and you might think it's really weird, some of the journals and the older articles, that the color figures, they have like all these panels and it didn't relate all together. And the figure legend is like talking about this part and about that part, because they want it in one figure, because you only want to pay $2,000 once and not things. And then you see a publication come out of a pharmaceutical company, for example, and they would have like 10 color figures. And you think, oh yeah, pharmaceutical company. And they're paying a lot of money. Nowadays, these open accesses, you don't have to pay it for color figures. So it's benefits. But still, money. That's what it takes to do these things. Some differences, though, just to get you understanding about some of these processes. In Canada, the researchers, because I was there for 4 years as postdoc, they don't have indirects on their grants. The states are cantons, or provinces, they call it. Cantons are Switzerland, which is like states. The province has money. National government gives provinces money. And then they allocate to the universities. And then the university has so much money to run their university. There is no indirects. So they're not whipping you grants, because it doesn't matter. It's not going to be a business for the university. So you can just do your research, write your grants for your research, and you're not being whipped by the university to bring in grant money. Switzerland was the same way. If you had a position in a university there, that was my first postdoc for 4 years, my postdoc advisor, he was from the States initially. He was a professor at Harvard, Yale, and Stanford, and then he moved to be the chair position at University of Basel. And he said, Cooper, you wouldn't believe this. Look at my grant proposal. It was 2 pages. And he had funding for the next 2 years. It was just, you know, he had right, because once you have a position there, I mean, they're pretty careful who they get. But once they had a position, they want to keep you going. And of course, you had to train Swiss students, undergraduates, as well as graduate students. But then there was a lot of money for postdocs from other places. Pretty interesting to think about the differences in different places. Canada, just to let you kind of think about things. Switzerland, they'll hire Swiss first when you're looking for a job in the university. If they can't find a Swiss, they'll hire outside. But the Swiss students, the graduate students, they basically had to do a postdoc somewhere else and apply back because they wanted you to have the experience outside. Canada, Canadians first. If you can't find a Canadian, they'll hire outside. So I applied for multiple jobs in Canada. My postdoc advisor, which was pretty well recognized, Harold Atwood, Margaret Atwood's brother, if you read stories, he was an excellent writer too. We always joke that he used his sister for writing his papers, but he was just a really good writer. He told me, he said, but you know we hire Canadians first. And I said, well, should I change citizenship? And he said, no, you know, it's going to be hard to do that because our son was born in Canada. But then he said, well, you can apply, but, you know, write the letters and everything. But it was so hard. It was basically, I'm sorry, we have a Canadian for this. We have a Canadian for this. We have a Canadian for that position. So you kind of think, and the U.S. is open internationally, so which is probably pretty good because it's international competition, which is the best you can get for that position, right? So there's pros and cons to it all, but it's something to be awakening up to and try to think about things, right? So it's interesting. Sorry to get off on that, but I think it's good to understand a little bit of all the processes involved. Okay, yes,
so
Julie.
Last question. So Canada has 0% indirect. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, as far as I know, it's 0% indirects.
Got it. Okay.
So go to Canada, write your grant. But so Canadians, and this was brought up a couple times, is that they will give more student, more people, more researchers money, but they're lower grants because they don't have to do this indirect. So they like to spread it out and try to keep everybody funded that's in universities already. So once you get a position, you're pretty likely to get your grant because they want, they don't want to waste money on a setup and you get setup money for your lab. Because usually when you get a position, like here, you get so much money to set up your lab. They want you to survive, right? So you get equipment, you can do something. But in that time, you got that money, and maybe it's only for 2 years. It used to be, when I came 30 years ago, I've been here for 30 years now, my salary when I first came was 41.5. That was the going salary for assistant faculty. It's pretty bad. 41.5. And then you got $150,000 to set up your lab. $150,000, that was it. So you buy equipment, and I was thinking, I love invertebrates. I love electrophysiology because you buy electrophysiology equipment, it lasts. I'm still using stuff from 1996 when I came here. Wow. And because I don't have to rebuy it. You do a molecular biology project, you're buying your reagents all the time. You're doing a rodent project, mice, something like that. You have to pay vivarium cost. It's very expensive. Your indirects get used up very quickly. And then if you don't have a grant, how are you going to pay for the mice colony? How are you going to pay for supplies? This is things to think about. And this is when people then don't get tenure and they can't survive because they didn't get their grants and they can't publish, they can't continue their research. What do? They're dead in the water, right? So this is the problem. So these are the things to think about. If you're successful and you can keep going, you know, that's part of it, right? So this is the ballpark about it. But in Canada, they try to fund a lot of different people, but it's lower grants, but you can survive.
So the university pays for, like, the all lab equipment and stuff? Or the,
yeah, you get an indirect.
The publishing costs and all that stuff?
Well, not all of it. You had to pay, no, you had to pay for your own publications and stuff. But they'll have money that you can write for and do things. Right, okay. Undergraduate, you know, hey, I'm going to publish this. When I was in the University of Toronto with my postdoc, I went down to this one place, this person I was talking to, and he said, well, come down with me, and we were talking about a proposal. And we went to the basement of the Children's Hospital. Children's Hospital in Toronto was one of the best ones in North America, actually. It's really good. It's very big. We went to this basement room. I said, well, what is this? He said, oh, I got to turn in this grant, this draft thing, and I got to talk to somebody. I said, well, what do they do down here? They have a whole bunch of secretaries that do what? Polish their grants, do all their references for them, make sure the figures are all good, and make sure it's written really well. And they have to... In Canada, a lot of these things are written with an abstract in French as well as in English because it might be going over to somebody else that kind of reads it for general because it's two languages, it's a national language in Canada. But they have secretaries that would do their grant proposals for them, basically, and proof it, make sure it's all perfect. And I think, oh, my God, we don't do this here at all. And so you wonder about success rate and things. These are things to think about. Yeah, don't do it and figure out your reference. And, you know, I type with two fingers, so I'm like, finger cramps. So, this is insanity. It's just insane. Sorry. We got off on a real tangent. Okay. But I think it's good to kind of be aware of lots of things. There's so many differences in so many ways. Of course, healthcare is something you could talk about in both places, Canada and Switzerland, where I was, it was all nationalized healthcare. You could just organize and didn't have to pay anything, but you did pay more taxes for it. It was pretty cool. In Switzerland, you couldn't have a job. You wouldn't get a payment. You wouldn't get a paycheck unless your company showed that you were actually paying health insurance. And they would help pay for half or something or part of it, but you had to have health insurance to get paid. So everybody was covered one way or the other if you're working. Or you couldn't have a job to work, so everything's covered. It's really amazing. We won't go into that. Okay. So what I have here, and I will Don't stress out. What I'll do, this is why we have donuts, to keep you alive today. We're going to kind of go through these chapters and hit some of the highlights like we did, but you probably fall asleep. What I'm going to do is, I just didn't have time to type it all up or copy these things that I think are really interesting about smooth muscle. And what I'll do is I'll put those together in a file and send it to you, so we make sure that we kind of hit the main things, because I sent you all the PDFs, but it's a lot. So I'm just going to take like snips of these different things. But these chapters, I mean, this is phenomenal. So many different things, okay? But some of these things we talked about, and it's kind of repetitive. But I think we just finished talking about this topic, which was really interesting. A lot of the smooth muscle cells don't have a really low resting membrane potential, you know, very low negative resting membrane potential. They're usually a little bit higher up, more depolarized. So they're closer to the voltage-gated calcium channel that can open up and allow calcium to come in. So that was kind of interesting. But different tissues, even in the GI tract, the small intestine, different regions in the small intestine, in the colon, or the stomach, have different resting membrane potentials, and they have inherently different pacing potentials to it. If there's food in there, there's a different contraction rate that they have. So you can listen to your stomach, you know, put a stethoscope on your stomach, and you'll hear your ruling, growling basically, but you can find out if you recorded from it or took it out, there's a different pacemaker potential basically in these different regions of your GI tract, which is really interesting. And how is that regulated, right? Smooth muscle. Okay, so that's pretty cool. We talked about K2P channels. Remember, those are the ones for resting membrane potential. They're like the leak channels, and different types of those, I think we talked a little bit about. They're finding out there's different types in different regions of the small intestine, and some of those are stretch activated. So when you have peristalsis and this bolus of food is going through and stretches, then that causes a contraction, right? And then moves it on down, and then that stretches and that causes that contraction. And that these K2P channels are acting like stretch activated channels, as well as having stretch activated channels that are in that membrane. So that's pretty cool. This was interesting, and something that we talked about maybe before, when we were talking about ion channels. There's just so many wild things in these chapters. The sodium channels, voltage-gated sodium channels, you know, when you open up and you have an action potential, what happens? The sodium channels open, then they inactivate, and you're opening up potassium channels to bring it back down. If you depolarize neurons, for example, slowly, like raising your potassium levels, for example, and you depolarize them, you open a few sodium channels, voltage-gated sodium channels, and they go in an inactive state. If you keep raising your potassium, you depolarize a little bit more, you could be above threshold that would normally activate an action potential, but you won't get an action potential. Why? Because you opened up a few of the voltage-gated sodium channels and they went into an inactive state. And then they're going to stay in an inactive state until you come back down to resting membrane potential. So if you slowly depolarize, you have a potassium problem, you've inactivated those, and now your threshold is much higher to be able to fire an action potential, fire those neurons. So this is weird. I found this really weird. Additionally, it was assumed that the voltage-gated sodium channels would be mostly inactivated, because what we just talked about is that they're more depolarized, right, these cells? You would think then they can't fire action potentials because they've inactivated so many sodium channels. Can you see this mess? But they still have sodium currents. So that means even though they're depolarized, they're not inactivated. So they're probably a different isoform of voltage-gated sodium channels. I mean, this is, you know, you wouldn't think of that, you know, that would happen. So that was really cool. This was quite interesting, and this probably scared researchers. Primary cultures of human aortic smooth muscle cells show abundant tetrodotoxin-sensitive sodium currents. So tetrodotoxin is from that pufferfish. It blocks sodium channels, voltage-gated sodium channels. Whereas freshly isolated smooth muscle cells from the same artery were devoid of those sodium currents. Wow. So your experimental conditions altered how they behaved. And you want to do your experiments thinking about what happened to the animal, but you're getting different currents depending on how you're handling those things in culture. So that is like, whoa, that's just confusion, right? So how are you going to do your experiments if you're getting different states when you culture your cells and trying to make predictions? That's really wild. All right, so these voltage-gated sodium channels If you get a lot of sodium inside the cell, what's that going to do? That's going to drive, you know, high sodium. Sodium then wants to go out, and that could allow calcium to come in through the sodium-calcium exchange, because normally sodium is really low on the inside, right? And calcium's high on the outside, and sodium's high on the outside. But if you start to raise sodium inside, sodium wants to go out, and calcium's already high on the outside, it'll start to come in. So now you've induced calcium to come in, and then we know what that can do to smooth muscle. That can cause the whole contraction process. So that's really wild, because then it's not just calcium channels opening right away. It's the exchanger that makes a big difference, right? So, and that's not an energy dependent process. As an exchanger, doesn't require ATP. Pretty neat. And then I don't think we got to this part, but they found out that there's actually, so here's your different TTX concentrations on the sodium channels. So these are pretty high concentrations too. In a lot of neurons, it just takes very little to block them completely. So that's kind of pretty high. But they even found chloride channels in smooth muscles. So chloride can go into the cell, and if chloride goes in, it's negative, so it could hyperpolarize the cell. So they found chloride channels that are sensitive to calcium inside. So if calcium's there, then the chloride channel can open. That's interesting too. So it's like a bringing it back down to rest again, right? So if calcium came in, well, let's open up a chloride channel, let's bring it back down. So that's kind of neat. Then they found out that there's other channels that are sensitive, but they're chloride channels, but a different type, that's sensitive to the osmolarity around the cell. So basically, if it swells or shrinks, you could have a change in the chloride current. Wow. All these variations, right, that go on. So that's pretty amazing. I know this could be a little boring going through this book, but let's go get some sugar. Okay. All right. So the main point is a lot of different types of potassium channels. There's many different types of potassium channels. And what they're finding is there's different ones in different regions of the smooth, different types of smooth muscles, okay? And in different critters. So let's go through this. So this is, we talked a little bit about G proteins in that first video that we looked at. The other day, we talked about, you know, some cellular cascades. So I just want to briefly talk about that there's lots of G proteins, because these are related to what hormonal, usually receptors from hormones, and then they'll turn on G-coupled proteins, and that's where we could really think about variations. I didn't realize that the mammalian genome had over 400 non-olfactory G-coupled proteins. Why? Because the olfactory system, many of the sensory neurons in our nose, for example, the receptors themselves, there's some that are ionotropic, but many of them are activated through, or the activity of the neuron is activated through G-coupled proteins. So they just specified it that's non-olfactory because there's so many in the olfactory system. But 400, in addition to those, is just like, good grief. There's a lot of work to be done still, right? So I don't want you to have to memorize this stuff, but to kind of be aware a little bit. And we'll look at a figure a little bit. But there's different types of G-coupled proteins. S is usually stimulatory. I is inhibitory. If you had cell biology, you probably covered all this stuff. There's a whole family called GQ-coupled receptors. And so the GIGO generally will mediate inhibition of analyte cyclase. Remember when we talked about that? And we were talking about, oh, they were only showing the alpha receptors, right, that went through GS, and that then caused calcium to increase. Well, GO, which we questioned about in that figure, they didn't talk about that, but the beta adrenergic receptors, they could then activate GO, which is inhibitory, right, and it could cause dilation instead of having cyclic AMP up. So it's kind of neat. And I'll copy some of these figures just so we have it kind of like, hey, here's snips of these different topics, okay? But this is the whole idea, is that you could have inhibition or excitation. We talked already about in that video, so it's a lot of rehashing on that video. IP3 cascade, which dumps out calcium. These then phosphorylation dependent steps that then can control relaxation and contraction. But here's something that's wild. So they're looking at a lot of these that are under modulation, like with hypertension, atherosclerosis, things like that, to try to find out if they can regulate these different processes to cause differences in blood pressure, for example. So they're finding out a lot in this atherosclerosis or hypertension that you're having altered gene expression of these particular types of G-coupled proteins. But there's this table that has gone awful. They just look at all these G proteins, I mean, and the different ligands that will stimulate it. So acetylcholine, we've talked about, adrenergic, adenosine, angiotensin, we talked about that. But there's a lot of others all throughout this. And so we talked a little bit about oxytocin, prostaglandin E2, they close your ductus arteriosus, for example, that we talked about. So there's just a tremendous amount, and in this nice little table, if you were really into this, they tell you the different tissues which have these different types of receptors. And then you realize, oh, you just can't make a generalized statement, right? It depends. So that's really quite amazing. And they still continue on for another whole page of, you know, different types of activation. Serotonin, for example, urotensin is really interesting. There's a compound called neurotensin they found from some fish in the brain of a fish, which they isolated and found out that is really good, and it works in humans, but we didn't make it ourselves. So they could inject that into rodent models and find out it really causes, you know, very strong contraction, more so than are the compounds that we normally use. And so it's, you know, by looking at comparative aspects, you might come up with new pharmaceutical agents that could be used. So it's kind of interesting to keep a comparative aspect in mind to it. And then the ones that would actually cause relaxation of smooth muscle. Adenosine, dopamine. You probably heard a long time ago they used to use dopamine if you had a heart attack, for example, instead of taking nitrous oxide or, you know, under the tongue, they would actually inject you with dopamine and it would help with the heart attack, right? So make a vasodilation. And now they don't use it because it's too many side effects of the dopamine. So it used to be standard, like ER type of things. So that's kind of interesting. And then you talk about more regulation of smooth muscle cells through G-coupled proteins. So one that's interesting, it's an E2 compound agonist, and so it causes uterine contractions. You might have heard of this drug. It was quite controversial because this you could actually buy on the internet, really bad, you know, Amazon.com or something, and you could get these medications sent to you directly. This was what was very highly talked about for a long time. This is actually used as a contraceptive. It can cause abortions, for example. People use that. But it's, if you buy it and you get a prescription from a physician, they basically make sure that you're not pregnant. But you could, this is a drug that is very strong in contractions, so they won't want to give it to somebody that's pregnant. But sometimes they have to give this to induce contractions too, like oxytocin after delivery, for example, and you want the placenta to come out so they don't have to rip it out. But are you bleeding, give that drug because it will cause contraction and stop the bleeding too. But kind of interesting because this one had kind of controversy about trying to regulate it more, being able to buy it off the internet. Anyways, okay. So that's kind of neat. Oh God, the time just disappears. Okay, so a little bit about calcium channels, because calcium is so important, right? And there was a tremendous amount, it's kind of eye-opening to me too, a lot of different types of calcium that could enter, or different channels that could allow calcium to enter into the smooth muscle cell. We've talked about some of those before, like the voltage-gated channels, but there's other ones that are really interesting. And they didn't mention it in that YouTube video that we were watching. They basically said DAG doesn't do anything, it just sits in the membrane. Well, here they talked a little bit more about it, that it can actually work on a calcium channel and actually allow sodium and calcium into the cell too. So we're not just about IP3 causing calcium release from internal stores, but the DAG that's there, depending on if this other protein is in that same membrane, that could also lead to calcium entry. So now you got two things coming in from activating that receptor, which could be activated by, in that case, it was angiotensinogen, right, that was activating, or vasopressin. All right, so that's kind of interesting. calcium signals, they divide these up into sparks and puffs, and depending on the smooth muscle cell, you get sparks or puffs, which is kind of interesting, because what are these? The spark is something that would be really fast, calcium rise, and a puff is more gradual. It depends on the cell type, so it's really kind of interesting. So here's puffs, and then calcium waves, and you might think about that in the GI tract, right? Those shorter, long, low frequency and waves that can help for peristalsis. And if you know that if you drink a lot of coffee and you know, you're gonna go do a race, for example, run, what do you wanna do ahead of time? You wanna get the poop out of your system. So what do? You drink some coffee, go to McDonald's, get their coffee, it's pretty toxic, and you drink that, and then that will help you to go poop before your race, right? So this is what a lot of people do. They really load up on coffee before the race, probably psychological too, but that helps with getting the GI contraction going so you can actually run a little easier. We talked about calcium clearance systems already. This was kind of interesting. Different tissues use these different ways to clear calcium. It was found in the mouse, they order that NCX that we were talking about, sodium calcium exchanger. 90% of the calcium is exchanged by that. There's something else that's in many cells. It's called the plasma membrane calcium, PMCA. Plasma membrane calcium ATPase that pumps calcium out. But if this one uses an exchanger, what does that mean? It doesn't have to use ATP, right? So here we have an exchange that we're not using ATP. That's really good. 90% of that one. Okay, so pretty cool. And then how does the sodium potassium ATPase pump, you know, play a role? Well, the pump plays a really major role, right? Because it's pumping sodium out, potassium in. If you poison the pump, this is the thing on the heart, for example, people regulate your heart rate by using drugs that block the sodium calcium ATPase pump. How does that increase your contractility of your heart? It seems kind of weird, right? So here's your heart cell, you know, contracting cell. If you have a sodium potassium pump, pumping sodium out and potassium in to maintain the RP, but if you block that, what happens? Sodium can't get pumped out. So sodium builds up inside the cell. Well, on your heart cells, you have the sodium calcium exchanger. So what did we just talk about? Sodium builds up on the inside and calcium's high on the outside. It promotes calcium to come in, not through a voltage-gated calcium channel, but through the NCX. And now you got more calcium in, so what's gonna happen to the heart contraction? Stronger, more forceful contraction. So using drugs that block the sodium-potassium isoform that's specific to the heart, you can actually increase contractility of the heart. And this is the drugs that they're using today. So it's kind of interesting. And that sodium-potassium ATPase pump is a different isoform than in your skeletal muscles and your nervous system. So it'll bind to some drugs at a higher affinity, but the side effects could be, it might be working on skeletal muscle, it might be working on your nervous system if you get too high of a dose. So it's tightly regulated, but it's kind of cool, you know, knowing on all these systems that can work to do that. This guy got the Nobel Prize for that. He described the sodium potassium pump in what animal? Anybody remember? 350ites, I know you've purged all those things, in crab muscle, crab skeletal muscle, where the pump was first isolated and understood how the sodium potassium ATPase pump works. It was in crab muscle, and then that opened up the whole ball game. So you understand why comparative physiology is really good. I mentioned this before, but this just reemphasizes it. It's pretty cool. The differences in smooth muscle types themselves is often greater than between smooth and skeletal muscle. Means there's so much variation in smooth muscle that it's even beyond trying to compare, you know, the skeletal muscle differences. And I thought that was really, because there's so much variation in the processes that go on. Okay, we talked about muscle contraction already, and we had those nice videos that we saw. And just to quickly kind of go over it, you could have electrical stimulation, you could have mechanical stimulation, you could have what we just talked about, alpha and beta dilation, alpha constriction, generally, right? Those aspects. And so here's like a little diagram that we'll put in the summary that we're going to put together. Mechanical, electrical, chemical, you know, G-coupled proteins, we talked about mechanical already, all related to a lot with calcium, right? And then here, contraction. Pretty cool. This text, which we didn't get in the videos, but there seems to be a lot more of these other little proteins that actually cause phosphorylation. I never heard of these before, but they're specific. So we get something, a zipper interacting kinase that actually can do phosphorylation processes, kind of like we already talked about with Rho kinase. So lots more out there than what we initially get exposed to on those short videos. So how does all this work? We talked about these dense bodies that are in smooth muscle, because why? These smooth muscles have to contract, and they're not attached to a cytoskeleton. I mean, they're not attached to, I'm thinking cytoskeleton of invertebrates. They're not attached to the skeleton, you know, the bones in us, right? So they're contracting against their own membrane, which is, you know, how do they do that without tearing their membrane? So here are these dense bodies, which is mostly the Z-disc, and the Z-disc, even in skeletal muscle, has the anchoring proteins that go to the plasma membrane, like dystrophins, for example. So these dense bodies then go with all the scaffolding and all that scaffolding to help anchor the plasma membrane to the contracting elements inside. Just kind of interesting there. So it's basically the same point that we just mentioned. They don't have tendons and skeletal bones to attach to, so they have to attach these kind of anchoring things. And then there's a whole chapter on pathologies, and they show about some of these anchoring proteins that are defective genetically, and then they have problems with GI contractions, cardiac development, and all kinds of things you can imagine. Okay, so scaffolding proteins, really important, many different types, more than I ever imagined in smooth muscle. We won't go through all this stuff, but we did talk about that there's different types of smooth muscle, and vascular system, GI system, and even in the airway. So they separate out these smooth muscle types because they find different isoforms of these myosin heavy chains that are in there. We talked a little bit about multi-unit and single unit. So they seem to identify the different smooth muscles in the groups by their myosin isoforms, and if they're single units or multi-units. Remember, a single unit means they all work together. Multi-unit, these are connected, these are connected, these are connected, but not all together. So neural innervation, for example, might be on the individual units so they can function individually, whereas single unit means they're all communicating together with what, gap junctions. So gap junctions. Okay, so it depends on where they are. And we already covered a little bit about that in that video about tonic and phasic. So this is the idea of seeing the tension that's developed with phasic. And remember that tonic can be keep that contraction for hours and not use ATP. So it's very energy efficient. Some of those use specifically types. And we won't go through all this stuff. But they found out that there's different types of actin that's in these smooth muscles. So they call them basically alpha and gamma smooth muscle actin, and it depended on the type of tissue that you're at. So this actin is for the contraction process, but look, they did this nice graph about these tissues have more and more and more of that one type, and the other one has more of this other type, and it changes the stiffness of the smooth muscle cell. So that was kind of interesting that there's lots of differences, and that could be the strength of that smooth muscle cell, for example. Just wild that they even thought about all these. We talked about myofilial cells before a little bit. I'm just gonna cruise through some of these things that's quickly. Microcirculation, we didn't talk too much about it except for the development that was weird about blood islands on the heart that then develops a coronary system. Wild stuff. But of course, these microvascular systems are what regulates blood flow to different organs in your heart, for example, but also in your periphery. So if you want to have more blood flow to your skin for vasodilation so you can sweat, then you could allow blood flow to go to your skin more. But if you are cold and you want to keep the blood from going out there, then you can constrict these and have like anastomoses that go back to your from your arteries, arterioles, right, that they're going to go through to your veins and come back so that it doesn't go through your capillary beds out in your hand, right? So this is the idea. So they control that blood flow and control your peripheral resistance, basically. So that was just basically all that stuff. All right. There's a whole section on uterine smooth muscle, but we talked about that kind of already, about oxytocin. But they do, in this chapter, went through quite a bit of it, of the different actions of progesterone, thank you, couldn't say that, and oxytocin having different actions inside the cell and how they're regulated differently. So that was kind of neat. And we already talked about some of the contractions with uterine muscles. And here was the idea that you could, that it takes calcium to come in with oxytocin, that you needed the calcium. If you took out the calcium, you couldn't get the actions to go. So it was a very much a to prove that it was a calcium flux across the cell. All right, let's hit some of these main things. We talked about adaptation a little bit, but the text really, this chapter was interesting more on pathology. If you have problems and you have more reactive oxygen species, then that can actually cause so much changes in the layers of your arterioles and your capillary beds, and then those can then have this metabolizing nitrous oxide, and then you have the superoxide free radicals that then just cause more damage, and then you have inflammation. You have immune cells that invade, and then you get the cytokines, and then the cytokines make cells leaky, and then you get more cytokines to come in because they think there's damage from some invading process. So it seems like this downward spiral effect that you really don't want. But it got into a little bit craziness about all the pathways, which we don't need to go into. But here's something, myogenic tone. This was kind of interesting about the stretch-activated channels. Let's see if I can get this going. That if you stretch it, it will then, we know that you're going to activate stretch activated ion channels, and then that's going to allow calcium to come in to contract. But then that change of contraction isn't just elastic recoil, it's there's actually messengers that are turned on to relax the muscle cell, like what we talked about, inhibiting cyclic AMP. So it's not just a rebound, which I thought it was before, you know, like elastic recoil, which is called the Wincastle effect in your aorta. Maybe that's more of elastic recoil, but in your some of these blood vessels, it was actually a cyclic process that you're inhibiting the cyclic AMP, and that allowed the muscle cells to relax. That kind of blew me away. So it's this cyclic process that goes on. So we won't go through all that. Okay, and they went through all the different cascades and the different ways that it phosphorylation. All right, there was something I wanted to get to before we get out of this class. Oh, gap junctions, like we talked about, single units all the way through. And if we look at it, there's different, all these different types of gap junctions, and they have different units that come together. But gap junctions are very bizarre, because why? This cell has to make the right unit, this cell has to make the right unit. There are little subunits that come together, and they have to line up perfectly well. So all the different subunits have to line up to make a pore. Some gap junctions allow current to go better one direction than the other. That's still a mystery, but some of it is that because these different subunits allow the electric current to go through one way or the other. What they also found out is the gap junction is calcium dependent. So when calcium is inside the cell, it allows the gap junction to work. If you take out calcium completely, the gap junctions don't work well. Mind-blowing stuff. Okay, very interesting. And here's more craziness to try to understand it all. A family of connexin genes, so these are connexins, the one type of gap junctions, comprised of 20 members in the human. So in humans, 21, mice, 20, different types of genes that would make these gap, you know, connexins. So you can imagine the variety that you have. If you got that many varieties, then think about all the pathology that can go along with it, right? So it's kind of just interesting to think about. So magnesium, example, some of these cases, an example of potassium channels by magnesium. Some of these ions could actually block gap junctions, so this, they're thinking that might be the rationale for allowing current to flow better one direction than another direction. We don't have to get into all the details, but they actually have these nice little graphs about seeing the, how you can get current going one direction versus the other direction based on different subunits that are made in the channels.
So yes. I know that there are the different connections, which are the subunits for the gap junction. But in that first figure that you showed, they showed there were two types, like hetero,
yes,
homotypic.
All being the same or being mixed.
Yeah, so that's how you get a different combination of,
yes,
like permeability and all that.
Yes. How they make those, how they all line up, mystery, right? It's your heart needs these because this is the electrical flow in your heart, but in single units too, or even in multi-unit, don't have the misconception that the multi-unit's only one cell. There's a group of cells that would be connected still by gap junctions, but the next unit's not connected to the gap junctions. So that was kind of nice the way they explained that in the text in there, that there's still gap junctions, but they're not all connected together.
The interesting thing they showed was the different subunits between the two cells communicating. This one could make connection A,
mm-hmm,
this one could make connection B, but they'll still connect.
Yes. How they do it. Mysterious stuff. And this is the idea of the electrical flow that can happen through this. So you just needed maybe a calcium activated, you know, some kind of receptor. Here it's acetylcholine, our BK channel, right? We talk about BK channels. And you get this big calcium surge, well, that can depolarize these potassium channels, it could hyperpolarize this membrane, that could transfer right on down. And then that would work on the, these are like epithelial cells on the outside, and then here's your smooth muscle cells. So communicating to the smooth muscle cells, but also gap junctions through the endothelial cells that could carry that electrical signal. So different connexins, here's a whole different type. They give them these numbers based on the molecular weight of the connexins, but then different ones in the smooth muscle cells versus epithelial cells, but the communication between the epithelial cells and the smooth muscle cells to allow that electrical flow to go. Never realized it was that complicated, but it seems a little bit much more complicated. Everything is when you start to dig down into it a little bit. Okay, and then they went through a little bit of it. We won't emphasize all these different things, but loss of specific connections, like what you're aiming at, Max, can end up in lethality for an embryo development. And why? Because a lot of the first things that really develop in a fetus is what? Cardiovascular system, right? To get blood around. So if the cardiovascular system is not working, then the rest of the body doesn't function. And you get, miscarriage. All right, there was something else I didn't want to torture you with everything, but you know, something that was interesting. I tried to highlight certain things. Oh, there's this weird thing. This was just weird. Never heard of it before. And I don't know, Gal-Gove phenomenon. It was basically trying to keep the blood vessels maintain their diameter. And depending on the pathology, you're building up more wall around it, but it keeps the diameter the same. And it might do that by even decreasing the tissue around it. And so this was a whole different aspect that I haven't really thought about. But changes in blood flow, inward or outward, they call it inward or outward remodeling. So outward would mean outside the blood vessel, that you're modulating that, versus inside, and maybe decreasing the number of cells that are in there or the thickness of the wall. So this is how they define some of these pathologies and modulation external. Then there's a whole chapter on erectile dysfunction because of smooth muscle with this blood flow to the erectile. So I was joking with some of the students in the lab yesterday. So you read through this whole chapter and it talks about erectile dysfunction. And basically, you've heard about this, is on the TV all the time, right? Viagra, 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 and all these different names that they give it. Basically, Cialis and all these different things. What do? They block the degradation of cyclic GMP. If cyclic GMP, so nitrous oxide by nerve stimulation will activate cyclic GMP. Well, cyclic GMP, if it's around, then it keeps it contracting. But it's a phosphodiesterase that breaks it down. So these drugs block the phosphodiesterase, so it won't, no. Did I just get that backwards? They'll block the phosphodiesterase so it will stay in a dilated state so it doesn't stay contracted, so then it can keep the blood flow going. But after reading this whole chapter, and it goes through the blood vessels and it's spongy tissue to get blood flow to it, so it's maintained contraction pretty much all the time unless you have this, let's see, here we go. Breakdown of cyclic GMP in this particular smooth muscle is achieved through the action of phosphodiesterase. The high successful oral treatments, Viagra and all these, are inhibitors of the enzyme and result in increased flow, increased levels of cyclic GMP following some stimulation, so you can keep the blood flow going. And then they mentioned about that it stays longer than 4 hours. That's a problem because you're not keeping good blood flow around. And so we read through this whole chapter, and then I talked, they have three female students in the lab, and said, go through this whole chapter, and you look up, and you actually do in the PubMed, which I don't know what that triggers, clitoral dysfunction. There's no work on clitoral dysfunction, but the clitoris and the penis come from the same embryological origin. So if there's something wrong with erectile dysfunction, that smooth muscle, there must be something wrong at the same levels with the clitoris. But I couldn't find any real research on it. So it's very biased, and probably, like this textbook, this chapter just mentioned, it's so important for species survival, right? Because the reproduction. So it seems like they don't care about the females so much. Sorry about it. Imagine that. I'm sure these chapters and the research is done by males. So they want to understand how the males work. But I did find that to be kind of interesting. So the whole thing about pyrrhopism, I didn't know about this, is that persistent penile erection for a long time, and that can cause fibrosis to build up in the penis, and then that causes problems. But this was weird. Some drugs cause this problem, so maintained erectile dysfunction, drugs of hematological disorders, metabolic disorder, trauma, tumors, neurological disorders, and bites from spiders and scorpions. Good God. I just like, what? Is that specifically on that tissue? Or is it on the body anywhere? I'm just like, wow, that thing crawled up my leg. And I'm just like, wow, that's pretty good. But people with sickle cell anemia, for example, are more prone to this too. About 40% of people with sickle cell have this problem too. So this is interesting to realize that there's could be differences with this. And so clinically, it's important to pay attention to. I think that was most of this chapter. And look at that, of the different chapters. There was only one other thing that was kind of interesting, and they're now doing this. I just want to bring this up because this is now a standard treatment. They're looking at calcification in your arteries. And so they can do imaging now, and they can see where calcium is built up, and it's a prelude to atherosclerosis, or cardiovascular problems, because you don't have the distensibility anymore. So if they start to see that with imaging technology, then they say, oh, we got to worry about you, and we got to start to think about how to bring that down. But it's hard to get the calcium to come back. They will actually give you drugs that will actually help to break down calcium. That's wild, because you worry about your bones doing this as well. So this is an interesting process, that, and some people that just have more calcium built up in their blood vessels than other people. You've probably heard of calcium buildup even in skeletal muscle. You hit your skeletal muscle, damage it, you can get a calcium stone that develops there. Calcium will build up in there, and it'll be hard as a rock. It'd be just like your bone. So you're developing bone in your skeletal muscle because this calcification that occurs, and they have to go in and surgically take it out. Wild, isn't it? But this is kind of the idea too in your vascular system. So I thought that was quite interesting. Oh my gosh, we did it. Okay, so I will hit some of these main things that we went over, put those into an MS Word file so you have it just as your references, because I'm sure you didn't want to read all those PDFs I sent you, right? But it is kind of neat to see all these differences that we covered. So we covered smooth muscle that I never thought we would get. Thank you, Max. What do we want to do next week? Does somebody have a presentation they want to do or a paper that's interested? Otherwise, I'll pick something and we can. And I'll send it all to you this weekend. Maybe we can chit chat over a particular paper or two on a comparative aspect. But if anybody has something they want to go for,
I can't do it next week, but I can do it the week after.
Okay, good. And that was spring break, where you're not here, right? No, I'm joking. Okay, the week before spring break. Okay, but if you got something, we could start, you know, processing. It's low key. It's just something fun. If you have a paper or something you want to do, send it to us, and we'll send it out to the class, and we'll chit chat about it.
The GLP too.
Okay. Yeah. Whatever you want to do.
I think I have something I can send tomorrow.
Okay. Yeah, and send a date, and you know, or Tuesday, Thursdays. If you, you know, think about your exams in other classes, and so you can, you know, strategize how you want to. Grab a donut on the way out if you haven't had one, because you probably need it from staying, trying to stay awake after this class. All right, we survived. We made it. And then even try Google.
Okay.
And nowadays Google is like popping up everything, and they have the PubMed link.
Okay.
But then, you know, they don't, that stuff that they does, the AI stuff, it gives you information from journals. And
right.
It's all wrong. So,
right.
So you don't rely on that.
Okay.
So we'll find the primary paper. All right. Do you want this last donut?
I'm good. Thank
okay.
you.
Hi, how are you?